many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with US economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa, and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Irechi Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janatali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio, and this is some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Be with us. Chapter Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year, and the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. We'll listen to the continuation of the programs on Iran Radio. Now for this hour, we have Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Then it's time for Spotlight. Coming up next is Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering it down some questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You might find it Q&A on Islamic Beliefs in our website, iranradio.ir. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Sheikh Karimi to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
So, how is constant expectation of Imam al-Mahdi's reappearance reconciled with the belief in five definitive signs? Sheikh Karimi, would you explain on this question for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, this is a very, technical question, and I would like our dear listeners to pay attention to this discussion today. Because, alhamdulillah, as Shia, we are waiting for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is the concept accepted by all Muslims. All Muslims are expecting for the Mahdi, and all the followers of divine religions, they are expecting for the Savior. Now, when it comes to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, again, you see that from time to time we see some false claimants, and unfortunately some lay people following those false claimants of Mahdism. But the point is that everything that we need in the time of the major occultation or Al-Ghibatul Kubra is explained in the narrations.
All right.
Now, one of the points which is of great significance is about the signs of reappearance, Halaimul Zuhur. And we know that according to the narrations, the signs of the narrations are divided into two categories, definite ones and indefinite ones. What is the difference? I will explain. So we know that one of the Islamic concepts in Kalam, in theology, is called Bada.
All right.
Some people have attributed only to the Shia, but the point is that it is something rooted in the verses of the Quran. Mm-hmm. So Bada is an Islamic concept.
Yes.
So it means that in some cases, God reveals to people something other than what they thought would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, people at the time of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, they thought that his elder son Ismail is the next Imam.
Okay.
But later Bada happened, meaning that God revealed to people something that they didn't think that it would happen. Ismail died, and Imam Kazim alayhi salam became the Imam.
All right.
Or for example, it's been recorded in the tablet of Mahw al-Ithbat that you are going to live, for example, for 40 years.
All right.
Then you do something good, your life span increases. This is called Bada, which is accepted by all Muslims.
Okay.
Now, the question is that when it comes to the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam mentioned in the narrations, will bada happen regarding these signs or not? For example, we have
in the first of all, what are the signs? Did you
I will mention
the five signs. That's right.
Okay. Before going to those five signs, the question is that will bada happen to a sign or not? For example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, for example, says that one of the signs of the reappearance is a flood in Euphrates, for example.
All right.
So if bada happens, means that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappeared without that sign happening at all. All
right.
Okay.
That's right.
So that is why we have in the narrations that there are two categories of the signs, definite ones and indefinite ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is exactly related to the concept of bada.
So bada is full stop of the event which is going to take place?
It may happen.
It may happen or it could be changed?
The details might change.
Might change indeed. That's
for example,
right.
Flood in Euphrates, then it might be flood in Tigris, for example.
That's right.
Or the month which is mentioned in the narration may change.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
All right.
So that is why the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam themselves, they have divided these signs into two categories. Alaim mahtumat, the definite signs, and alaim ghayru mahtumat, the indefinite signs. And which means that when it comes to definite signs, then bada or change will not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that is the importance of people coming to know about these five signs, definite signs. According to Shia scholars and the famous narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, for example, when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, قَبْلَ قِيَامِ الْقَائِمِ خَمْسُ عَلَامَاتٍ مَحْتُمَاتٍ. Before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, there would be five definite signs, meaning that for sure these signs will happen before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
What are they? The uprising of Yamani, the uprising of Sufyani, Sayha, the heavenly call, Qatl al-Nafs al-Zakiyya, the murder of a person called Nafs al-Zakiyya, and Al-Khasfa wal-Bayda, a group of the army of Sufyani will be swallowed up in a land called Bayda in the Arabian Peninsula. When it comes to indefinite signs, there are many mentioned in the narrations, for example, a solar eclipse in the middle of the month of Ramadan, the murder of a king called Abdullah, a lunar eclipse toward the end of the month of Ramadan, the kind of damage in Basra, the damage of the wall of the Kufa mosque, the struggle between three groups in Sham, Syria, the Euphrates flood, and, for example, a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and so on and so forth.
All right.
We have talked about these signs in other programs and other sessions, so I'm not going to go to that topic. So the question now is that, as I mentioned, will bada happen to definite signs or not? The famous idea among the Shia scholars is that when the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam themselves, they have mentioned that we have two categories of the signs, mahtumat and ghayru mahtumat, it means that then bada will not happen regarding the mahtumat, regarding the definite signs. So, for example, if Sufyani is considered as a definite sign for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, then for sure it will happen before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. For Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, إِنَّ خُرُوجَ سُفْيَانِ مِنَ الْأَمْرِ الْمَحْتُومِ. The uprising of Sufyani is mahtum, is definite, for sure it will happen. Or قَتْلُ النَّفْسَ الزَّكِيَّ مِنَ الْمَحْتُومِ. This is the viewpoint of, the majority of the Shia scholars.
Right.
And they argue that the very fact that we have two categories of the signs, refer to the fact that there is no bada in the definite signs. The other idea is that no, still we might have bada even in definite signs. Some Shia scholars believe in this. Now, going back to the main question, okay, we have these narrations referring to the fact that before the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we have five definite signs.
Yes.
Okay. Without them, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will not come. On the other hand, we have the narration, for example, Tawakkul Faraj al-Sabahan wa Masa'an. Wait for the reappearance in the morning, in the evening. meaning that, and other narrations refer to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come in a time that people may not expect the Imam to come. That is why each time we need to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is that it seems that these two are contradicting. We have definite signs, which means that Imam will not come before their happening. On the other hand, the fact that Zuhur may happen at any time.
And the signs are, we can say that you are referring to, some of them are very much the same as everyday natural disasters that are taking place.
Yeah, that is why, one of the questions
we cannot, at the end of the day, we can't say, understand and recognize, is this the very same
That's
sign?
That's a very good point that you mentioned, and we have discussed in the last Savior about the criteria for applying applying the signs to today's events, and we have discussed about those criteria. And I believe that when it comes to the five different signs that I mentioned, the issue is very clear. I mean, the uprising of a person called Yamani with all the features, and then Sufyani, As-Sayha, the heavenly call, which is a miracle, all these can lead the people. So there is no need, for people to go to indefinite signs and applying them. When it comes to different signs, they would help. Now, going back to the main question, are these two contradicting each other? First of all, as I mentioned, some Shia scholars, they believe that Bada may happen also in the definite sign. So if you agree with this, then there is no contradiction, which means that even for definite signs, Bada may happen, Imam may come without those five signs to happen. Which means that, there is no contradiction. Anytime Imam Mahdi alayhi salam may reappear.
All right.
But if we go with the famous idea that there is no Bada in the different signs, how can we solve these two issues? The point is that what is mentioned in the narrations as, the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam at any time, and the fact that tawaqqul faraja sabahan wa masa'an, this is referring to the process of reappearance, not the very coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
That's right.
Okay, and this process, will last at most, maybe less than 10 months, less than 1 year. Realization of all these different signs and the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they are interconnected and will happen very close to each other, right?
So in a shorter span, all of them will be together,
exactly,
so that the recognition of the true time of reappearance will
That's
be clear
the
for the people. That's right.
So when the narrations talk about the fact that these the concept of faraj may happen at any time, and you may expect that in the morning, in the evening, it is referring to the process of reappearance, and this process includes those definite signs.
All right.
Okay? So which means that at any time, people may see Yamani, Sufyani, and at the beginning of this process, and within a short span, within few months, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come.
Okay.
Okay, so there is no contradiction. This is one point, one answer given to this. And the other point is that the narrations talking about tawakka'u, the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is referring to the eagerness of the people, not the point that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam may come in this very morning. It means that each and every time show your
intizar. That's right.
Yeah,
okay.
That you are interested in the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. You are preparing yourself. So it is a kind of metaphor. Sometimes, for example, your beloved is in a journey. You know that he or she will come back to you after 1 year. Okay,
right.
Although you know that, but every morning you are waiting for him or for her coming back to you. And this is showing your love for him or for her, right?
All right.
The same can be mentioned regarding these narrations of tawakka wal faraja sabahan wa masa'an. It means that wait for the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Although you know that it might happen within a few months from now, but show your love, show your interest, and wait for the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, which is, also a factor for people getting prepared for the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Okay. So these are two main answers given to this very good question.
All right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding this concept. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
How is constant expectation of Imam al-Mahdi's reappearance reconciled with the belief in five definitive signs? It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, Atta, the host of the program, and Sheikh Karimi. For more information and also to download for free our other episodes, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran labani Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Inna fil jannati nahran لبني علي وحسين وحسن لي علي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن We'll be right back.
joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, Tehran says the International Atomic Energy Agency's approval of a U.S. and European drafted resolution at its Board of Governors meeting against Iran's nuclear program formally now ends an earlier understanding reached with the nuclear watchdog in Cairo. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi stated Iran has officially informed the Director General of the agency that the Cairo understanding is no longer valid and now considered terminated. He also emphasized the anti-Iranian resolution has undermined the credibility and independence of the agency. And what this resolution means at a time Iran is still reeling from a surprise June aggression from the U.S. and the Israeli regime, based in large part to the last damning IAEA Board of Governors resolution used as pretext, we'll be discussing in our Spotlight program.
A resolution proposed by the European Troika, France, Britain and Germany, with U.S. support against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, was adopted at the meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors in Vienna on Thursday. The resolution passed with 19 of the 35 board members voting in favor. China, Russia and Niger voted against it, while others abstained.
Iran has consistently demonstrated, in case of goodwill, seriousness, and constructive approach from other side, it is fully prepared for meaningful and constructive engagement. At present, however, the authors of resolution have chosen a different course, under the mistaken belief that the pressure and threat will yield result.
The resolution demands that Iran promptly report the whereabouts of the uranium stockpile at the bombed nuclear sites. Following the vote, Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi condemned the outcome and announced that the Cairo agreement signed with the IAEA in September had been officially terminated. During the session on Thursday evening, Venezuela delivered a joint statement opposing the resolution, which Russia, China, Iran, Belarus, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Zimbabwe signed.
We are of the firm's view that the course of action pursued by the co-authors of the draft resolution that was recently adopted risks creating the situation in which the Board of Governors would function in two parallel realities, similar to the present circumstances within the United Nations Security Council. And such an outcome, we consider, sadly, would seriously undermine the unity, credibility, and the institutional integrity of the agency.
The resolution came as IAEA Director General Grossi announced that IAEA inspections in Iran had resumed in recent weeks.
We have returned to Iran, and a number of inspections have taken place, more than a dozen.
In a strongly worded statement delivered on Thursday evening, Russia's IAEA Deputy Envoy Roman Ustinov said, "The Russian Federation refuses to be complicit in yet another escalatory step against Iran at the IAEA. The destructive consequences of such a decision are crystal clear to us." When Iran was in the middle of talks in Oman, the U.S. and Israel attacked nuclear facilities in the country to sabotage these talks. As cooperation between the IAEA and Iran restarted after these attacks, the European Troika submitted yet another anti-Iranian resolution. After these actions by the US and the E3, it's increasingly unlikely that trust in the agency can be reestablished. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
And now joining us for the program. Betul Sabeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief at Amena Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Ladies, hello. Welcome to both of you to our Spotlight program here. I guess we'll start there in London. Betul, with you. Good to check back in with you. Okay, let's take the political environment first into consideration, Betul. Iran is trying its best to cooperate with the IAEA, while it strongly believes that the agency, first, one, it lacks impartiality, that it is politicized, that it is compromised, and largely that it's responsible for allowing Iran's adversaries access to data they use as pretext to attack the country back in June. Your initial thoughts, please.
Yes, good evening to you, to your guests, and to all your viewers. The West, of course, uses the IAEA as part of their trap of diplomacy. The IAEA should have nothing to do with Iran's relations with the West politically. Its job should be technical. And when it becomes a tool of political pressure, Iran is aware and, you know, doesn't want to speak about other issues not related to nuclear or give into false allegations. But what has been proven is that the IAEA acts on behalf of Western political interests. After this has become clear, I believe Iran should even refuse dealing with Grossi and should stipulate someone else. So the crux of the issue is that this agency operates according to Western and American directives, functioning as a tool for monitoring, espionage, information transfer, a intentionally legitimate instrument, this is what the IAEA becomes, that allows entry into Iran's depths under the nuclear pretext. It is well known that such agencies, institutions, and organizations fall under American decision-making and do not go beyond it. So even Western countries you mentioned, the Troika, like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, they simply comply with American demands when requesting Iran to do illogical things that have no relation to the IAEA's mandates or obligations. You know, they have used this agency as a means, like you said, to spy on Iran, to provide information that the agency is supposed to preserve, yet it leaks this information to Israel. The information leaked to the entity contributed to the illegal strike on Iran last June, including the assassination of scientists, and the IAEA will continue to give intelligence information to the West. So this won't change, and Iran, of course, is aware of this. It will continue to reveal the secrets that it obtains from Iran, and the IAEA, therefore, I believe, can be regarded as a spy agent. Such a body also gave the excuse for the strike against Iran under the pretext of Iran not cooperating enough or supposed violations. And we can expect sometimes that groups within the agency may even engage in suspicious activities, included suspected planting of materials contaminated within certain enrichment levels, after which Iran is then questioned over the matter. So the entire issue to me appears to be a part of a broader war on Iran, an effort to probe and limit its capabilities using the nuclear issue as the declared pretext for this campaign, whereas actually a war on Iran's overall capabilities.
All right, very nice opening take there. Thank you, Batul Subeti. And Leila Hatoum out of Beirut, welcome to the program. Thank you for your patience. Now, Leila, Iran's... Okay, we know it's a shaky and fragile relationship between the IAEA and Tehran. Once flourished under the JCPOA with unprecedented access, a deal that Iran had no hand, we should mention, in ruining. Yet, here's the irony. Why is Rafael Grossi allowing that relationship be undermined today by the very parties that had a hand in ruining it?
Well, good evening to you, to your esteemed guests, and to the viewers as well. It's very interesting because we have discussed this in the past through your show as well. I mean, listen, Grossi in the past had accused Iran of hiding something. He issued a false statement at one point during and after what you call the Israeli aggression on Iran. And at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, I don't think that he was appointed to his post haphazardly. He didn't come because of merit or anything else. He was appointed to serve an agenda, as your own esteemed guest had pointed out. The IAEA works for the Axis of Evil, I'm going to call them, that's headed by the U.S., and that's basically working in favor of the Israeli entity. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing you have to understand, Grossi, who had basically at one point or another demanded to access Iranian nuclear sites, even after the Israeli occupation had bombarded alongside the Americans, Iran, he never did that with the Israelis, who are well known to have or to own the largest uranium, related bombs in the region, nuclear bombs in the region. So at the end of the day, when I look at the situation, one, Grossi is actually appointed to spy on the states that the Americans and the Israelis want to spy on. Two, to ensure that everybody complies with the Western agenda. Three, everybody remains under control of the West. And four, and that's the most important thing, if you cannot destroy them or leak their information, then go and accuse them of something to put sanctions on them and then bring them about back to what you call subordinates.
Thank you, Leila. Batul, Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi condemned the move, calling the resolution illegal and unjustified. He said the measure was adopted under pressure from these four countries, meaning the U.S. and the European Troika, France, the U.K., and Germany. He said despite opposition or abstentions from 15 board members. We have to ask, Batul, what and why? What objective do these four entities believe will result from this move, and why haven't other more constructive channels been utilized or entertained?
Right. So the issue is not related to Iran's nuclear intentions. I just think we need to be clear about that. Iran is still a member of the IAEA. Iran is still committed to its obligations under the NPT. The agency has not proven any violations or transgressions by Iran of its rights from the outset. It made claims, but those weren't substantiated. And we know that Iran was subject to the highest level of inspections that any state party to the NPT has undergone. So this tells us, and it's obvious, that the fear of Iran acquiring scientific capabilities that would enable it to defend itself is meant to leave Iran without real defenses. So ultimately, the goal is what? The goal is to get Iran to submit to the regional equations drawn by others, by the West, and for Iran to not interfere in ways that affects Western hegemony and interests. The goal is to keep the entire West Asia region open to Western intervention according to policies that serve Western strategies at the expense of the region's peoples. So the peoples of the region remain the consumers, unable to produce, unable to defend themselves against foreign aggression. Any voice that rises in the region, like Iran's voice or any voice of liberation resisting this Western authoritarian tendency, that must be suppressed. That is the Western goal. That is the core of the war on Iran, the nuclear file of which is used as a pretext. As for dealing with the European Troika in their decisions, they are merely following the American direction, becoming more rigid if America does, more lenient if America does. I believe they have no credibility, they have no independency or ability to make those independent decisions on matters that concern them unless approved by the American administration. But negotiating with them, to some extent, Iran has deemed necessary to avoid completely aborting that negotiation process. And all of this is an indication to us that the politics of power is working in the world. The world order is built on oppression and transgression. Even the terms and the institutions that the West itself creates, like the UN, for example, it did this to secure its own interests. And so when it comes to Iran, let's be clear, the IAEA is the transgressor. It has no proof against Iran, and it's accusing it in such a way.
Thank you. And Leila, same question, if I could put it to you. The reason for these continued efforts by the U.S. and the European Troika to undermine IAEA and Iran cooperation, and who does these damning reports benefit? You remember the one on non-compliance came the day before the Israeli regime's attacks on June 13th, and now this demand to force their way into sites that the U.S. bombed that week of mid-June.
Well, I'm going to start it with a question. Don't you find it very interesting that when the Americans said that they are sure that they hit what you call Iran's nuclear stockpile, and later on they tried to send the IAEA to double check, they weren't able to access those sites. Now what are they doing? They're trying to actually access those sites, and they're trying to bully Iran into it by issuing such statements and by issuing basically what you call a preliminary sanctioned kind of accusations. So when you look at the whole situation, you know that the Americans don't know for a fact if they actually hit that site or not. They want to access it to know how much damage they have basically inflicted against Iran, and they have no information. So they even lied to their people. Donald Trump lied to his people when he said, we destroyed their nuclear capability. They cannot basically stand on their 2 feet. If they actually are that sure, why are they trying to send the IAEA to go and inspect those sites? That's the first thing. The second thing, and that's very important, I'm going to add to what your esteemed guest had said. It's not only to ban countries from this region from having or acquiring power to defend themselves, because Iran had repeatedly said that it's not trying to create a nuclear bomb, so it's not going to use it for military, basically what you call uses. It's going to actually use it for the advancement of technology in the country to help its country develop better. The Americans and the Israelis, they don't want anybody developed. They want everybody to be subjugated to them through technology, among other things. And in that manner, I'll give you an example. I mean, forget Iran at one point. Let's take, for example, the U.S. own ally, Saudi Arabia, which has uranium in its own country, basically. They can actually mine for it. And the West, especially Europe and the U.S., were trying to pressure Saudi Arabia to actually send that uranium in raw material to Europe and to the U.S. so they can actually enrich it and work on it, and then send it back 10 times worth to the Saudis, who will have to pay for that price. And the Saudis said no. But we don't see the IAEA or anybody else basically intervening in that matter, despite the fact that this is basically uranium, and the Saudis are going to look into having what you call peaceful nuclear power. They only do it to Iran. Why? Because Iran is the only one that says no to the West. And this is very important. When you actually hit Iran in this region, that's the last, what you call, a wall. I'm going to call it the China wall, in the face of the Western advancement towards taking over all of this region.
Thank you. Very nice input there. Batul, when there was a channel for dialogue, the indirect talks that were taking place pre-June aggression by the U.S. and the Israelis, why didn't the U.S. stick to those talks? Why didn't it return to the JCPOA? Why did it abandon the JCPOA in the first place? And then the Europeans, they vowed if Iran stays committed post-May 18th of 2018, U.S. unilateral withdrawal under first-term Donald Trump there, they vowed that they're going to try to make sure Iran receives concessions if it sticks to the parameters of the agreement. Iran did for a whole year and a few months, and it didn't get any of the relief that it was basically promised it. They failed at that. So why is the onus somehow on Iran and not them to have constructive cooperation and engagement?
In the same way that limiting Iran's, missile range to no more than 500 kilometers has nothing to do with the nuclear issue, with the West claiming that it's the nuclear file that is really the issue, then why would they bring in the missile issue? And we saw this even during the JCPOA, or Iran's political influence in the region, or Iran's relationship with the resistance movements in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen. This tells us the crux of what all of these are about, whether it's the JCPOA and curbing Iran's ability to produce domestically, or if it's about launching a war in Iran. The nuclear issue is being exploited as a gateway to intervene in all these other areas to undermine Iran's nuclear direction, even though Iran, as we said, is committed to the IAEA's rules and laws, subject to its supervision, submits the required reports, and the agency conducts the required inspections. Iran is a party to the NPT. Yet this hostile behavior towards Iran uses Iran's very compliance as a pretext to cast out and to move towards the real issues. What is the real issues? The real issues is Iran's political role in the region. And of course, in these 2 years that we've seen, these 2 years of genocide, the Israeli occupation entity has been given the complete free hand to draw out the maps, the quote-unquote New Middle East Project plan, which Trump was 100% on board with. He himself in his election trail campaign spoke about Israel being too thin, it needs to fatten up, essentially. And that's why they decided to strike front after front within the resistance axis. You know, so this was their chance to militarily strike Iran and to topple its government. And we know that this is a U.S. Interest before it's even an Israeli interest, because it's the U.S. that is at the helm of leadership, and Israel cannot breathe without the American oxygen. So all of this goes back to the political role of Iran, encouraging regional forces to create their own security and to confront colonialist projects that are planted and relied on in this strange artificial Israeli occupation entity that was created in the region. And America has been using it as the foundation for their policies, with all the brutality associated with those policies and with the crimes committed. So the fundamental issue here is Western interests at its core.
And I often see, and I actually I'm going to have to skip a couple questions, because I'm glad that you touched on that, that it's all about the West's agenda for the region, Batul. And Leila, I want to put that to you. When asked, what more can Iran do at this point? Because it seems here, what it will take to end the U.S. hostility toward the country. Obviously, the country, the U.S. wants not to have a peaceful nuclear program, not to enrich uranium, not to have missiles and drones for its own defense, or aerospace program for that matter, and no more support for Palestinians fighting apartheid, occupation, genocide, and ethnic cleansing, and other oppressed people in the region?
Well, you have to understand one thing. The West will never stop trying to bully Iran and everybody else that it thinks would pose a threat to its advancement and hegemony. At the end of the day, the only thing that Iran can do is stop playing as a gentleman with ethics, because no matter what Iran does, they will continue to accuse it of things until Iran totally caves in, or until they have their way by changing the governing body at the moment in Iran. So that's their ultimate goal. We've seen it. They've said it, not me. Donald Trump said it. The Israelis said it, among others. So having said that, what Iran needs to do is to continue advancing or pushing its technology towards further advancement, not wait for the West to tell it what it needs to do or what it has to do, and then file a lawsuit against the IAEA or basically bring that matter to the United Nations, because the UN Charter actually says in Chapter 2, Article 2, Clause 7, it says that not a single state has the right to intervene in the internal affairs of a member state. The Americans are trying to do it through the IAEA, it's very evident. The European Union is trying to do it through the IAEA, and it's very evident. The Israelis are trying to do it through the IAEA, and it's very evident. So at the end of the day, what Iran can do is basically request the UN for help. And we know that the UN is basically a futile body to go to. But at the end of the day, they just like put it in their face. And then towards the end, you say, we tried our best. We gave you the reports, as Betul said. We have collaborated, as Betul said. And she mentioned, she extended it beautifully. And we've done everything that we can, including basically the Russians, who are members of the IAEA, who are taking care of some of the nuclear facilities in Iran. They came out and said there's no breaches. So towards the end, Iran will have to do one thing. Stand up and say, Khalas, that's it. We're cutting ties. They tried to do it earlier during this war, but I don't know why Iran resumed its basically what you call good ties with the IAEA if the IAEA is showing bad faith all the time. The good faith actor over here is Iran. It's not the IAEA. So what Iran can do, I mean, like, what's the worst that they can do? Like, put sanctions on Iran? They've done it. They've tried it for over a decade. They attacked it. I mean, what's next? So at the end of the day, Iran has the right to defend itself. It has the right to continue to advance its technology. It has the right to stop dealing with entities that are controlled by other nations who are trying to spy on Iran. You have the right to defend yourself in that matter. So, I mean, my opinion is basically to cut ties. But then again, I always go to what you call the harshest solutions. I know that Iran is all about diplomacy and talks and negotiations, but sometimes this doesn't work when you're dealing with a bully.
Really nice take there, Leila. Thank you. Betul, you can weigh in on this too. What more can Iran do at this point? It's been open to solutions, open to dialogue, open to talks with parties that have played one dirty game after another. And does the U.S. really think, Betul, it can bomb Iran's nuclear facilities and have Donald Trump parade around the planet bragging about it in front of cameras left and right, boast about it, and that Tehran will what, reciprocate those gestures with some kind of positivity?
Yes, I actually have the same take that Leila has, and that is what Iran shouldn't do, and that is to continue negotiating with the IAEA, because that is returning back to the same experience that Iran has tried and tested and been prey to, I believe, the deception of, you know, this deception that America won't strike us if we're in negotiations with the IAEA. You know, this was the case with the 12-day war. And deception can occur again. And, like, Israel can strike Iran when it decides to. And it's presumed that Iran, I hope, at any time that it negotiates, is taking into account that this is another deception and does its due diligence in all of this. Because even if new agreements relating to these inspections in the future are agreed, it remains that the IAEA is unreliable because matters are not in its hands. As we said, it moves according to the American directives. Now, on your question about Trump and the bombing campaign, I mean, look, Trump comes out and he says, we've destroyed, we've crushed, we've ended the Iranian nuclear project, and uses all these like victory-laden terms. But we know that there's really a message behind that, and that is one that contradicts reality and carries the taste of defeat. Trump doesn't want to hear anything about the Iranian nuclear file anymore. After Iran proved during the 12 days its military might and sent Netanyahu crying, asking for a ceasefire. And when Iran declares, so when Araghchi comes out and he declares, for example, that its nuclear facilities were significantly damaged, that too carries a kind of contradictory message, one that tastes like victory, as in, you cannot stop us moving forward. We have the pretext to do what suits our own interests. So I believe America's statements reflect incapacity, this recurring failure where major goals are set but not achieved. We saw this happen in Yemen when Trump declared he would unleash hell and end the Yemeni challenge in the Red Sea once and for all. Yet after 7 weeks, he declared victory himself without achieving any of his goals. So I believe after experiencing and discovering the true power balance on the ground, a new equation has been established now with Iran, and the threshold and the momentum required to start any new war has now risen, perhaps to a level where nuclear weapons would only be used in the most extreme madness of war under absolute desperation. And this new ceiling presents the West with new challenges. Either it acknowledges the new power balance on the ground, which has now been tested in a way that it's never been tested before due to those 12 days, because it was the first time in 40 years that Iran was at war, or America continues this hostile approach towards the Islamic Republic, which has also proven to be a failure after 45 years of sanctions that have backfired and produced this kind of resilience and strength despite a full and comprehensive embargo. So sanctions have failed, and what's left now is recognition and letting go of Western arrogance and superiority.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe to Batul Subaiti joining us from London, and Leila Hatoum joining us out of Beirut. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us. Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We are here and we continue our broadcast from Iran Radio with these incredible programs. Our next program is news, keeping you in the know with all the latest updates. Then we have A to Z of Life. Next up, we will dive into a collection of our finest radio productions. Following that, Islamic Laws clarifies faith for everyday life. Hujjatul Islam, Sheikh Jabir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death toll for Israel's genocide in Gaza is approaching 70,000 as the regime kills more Palestinian civilians in blatant violation of a ceasefire. Hamas strongly condemns Israel's frequent violations of the Gaza ceasefire, saying the regime is fabricating pretexts to restart its war of extermination.